So I want to deal with two deists and antagonists of Christianity who might be termed populist infidels. The most well-known example of this is Thomas Paine, who in his Age of Reason, especially the Age of Reason Part 2, mounted a frontal assault on Christianity. But Paine is a relative latecomer to this, not having written until the 1790s. The people that we're looking at today paved the way for populism in deism by sharpening their antagonism and by showing a willingness directly to deny the veracity of certain secular parts of the gospel narratives, unlike, for example, Wollstone. We'll see how that happens as we move forward. First person we want to look at is Thomas Chubb. Chubb was a candlemaker and a prolific pamphleteer. If he had lived in contemporary times, Chubb would have been a blogger and an indefatigable blogger. He would have responded to everyone without tiring until he dropped dead. In 1715, he began his literary efforts with a defense of William Whiston. You'll remember that William Whiston was deprived of his living at Cambridge, even though he had been one of the Boyle lecturers, because he was not a Trinitarian. He held Arian views on the nature of Christ. Chubb actually showed a draft of what he was writing to Whiston and got Whiston's approval for it. So he started off clearly aligning himself with the non-Trinitarian margins of the dissenting movement. But he moved further than that. Toward the end of his life, in his posthumous works, there's a long postscript which the editor says was found written in his own hand, and there he expresses doubts about prayer, doubts about Christ's miracles and resurrection, and doubts about a future life. So Chubb's overall trajectory was from non-standard Christianity toward a more despairing position. A quick outline of his thought seems in order. Chubb holds that in all cases, or almost all cases, that have to do with men's fortunes and circumstances, God has nothing to do with the matter. The operative causes are secondary causes, and there is no room for divine providence. You can find this at the page reference that I'm giving you if you want to chase it down. There is no hope and no expectation of divine assistance in the practice of what is good. So any appeal to God for strength under trial and temptation, for wisdom, right? If any man lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. All of that goes for nothing in Chubb's thought. It's your character formed by your circumstances that is your only hope in those situations. God isn't going to help you. Petitionary prayer, prayer asking for things, is pointless. Things will happen the same way whether we pray or not. And finally, the existence of a soul as distinct from the body is doubtful, as is the soul's survival of physical death, if indeed there is such a soul. With all of those points in view, it's not surprising that he has sort of wavering views on the question of a future judgment. If there is a future judgment, and he maintains in some places very orthodox sounding statements like Christ will judge the quick and the dead, but if there is one, very few people will face it. And if they do face it, the only thing for which they will be accountable is having a just sense of the kindness and beneficence of God and making public profession of gratitude for these. If you are familiar with the work of Brennan Manning, some of you may remember that Manning was a big influence on Rich Mullins. Brennan Manning famously says in his one of his books that the only question that Jesus will ask at the judgment is, did you believe that I loved you? And nothing further. Curious resonance there with Chubb's thought centuries earlier. Chubb held that a revelation is possible, but whether it's actually been given is doubtful, since, as he puts it, we have no rule to judge or from which we can with certainty distinguish divine revelation from delusion. This criticism is interesting both because of the target, the question of whether we can have a revelation at all, but also because of the appeal to certainty. You'll remember from one of the introductory lectures that a classic Catholic challenge to the Protestants was, what is your source of certainty? and the standard Protestant reaction hammered out by people like Chillingworth and Wilkins and Tillotson was to say, we don't require certainty, we require probability. Probability that may rise to a moral certainty, but not a metaphysical certainty. Probability that leaves us with no doubts, even if it doesn't logically exclude the possibility of error. I think that answer could well be given here. And to make his challenge then more interesting, Chubb would have to do one of two things. He would either have to give an argument that nothing short of certainty will do, or he would have to give an argument that what we have does not amount even to a probability, much less to a certainty. But as he doesn't do either of those things, I think he's left himself vulnerable here to that classic Anglican counterattack on the ground of probability. He also maintains that the Old Testament characterization of God is unworthy, and Jewish modes of worship are arbitrary. All of those things about not wearing cloth woven of two different kinds of fibers and not planting two different sorts of plants in the same field, they are so many wholly arbitrary commands and cannot be the dictates of reason. You can sense echoes here of Tyndall's thought, where Tyndall said, the original relation, oldest religion, that's oldest creation, is a religion of reason. And there cannot be any positive commands that reason itself would not already have given us. Well, reason's not going to tell you not to wear cloth woven of two kinds of fibers. How ridiculous. So these arbitrary rules and the apparently vindictive and nasty character of God in the Old Testament is unworthy, and so Judaism should just be set aside. How one is to understand the New Testament without seeing it as a work that comes out of the matrix of Judaism is a question Chubb doesn't even attempt to answer. I think it's pretty plainly impossible. Nobody's going to be able to read Matthew's Gospel and understand Matthew as he understood himself without seeing this as something that's rooted in Judaism very firmly. But of course, this is an old turn of thought, the heretic Marcion, one of the first people that we have record of actually being excommunicated by the church, maintained that the God of the Old Testament is just a different being from the God the Father revealed in the New Testament, and the church was having none of it. Another thing that Chubb is famous for is saying that unless Scripture is interpreted so as to be made conformable to the great rule of right and wrong, as he puts it, it must needs be an unsafe guide to mankind. Okay, well, can we interpret it according to that rule? No, says Chubb. There are large parts of it that just won't be interpretable that way. Therefore, since we cannot reconcile ourselves to the morality of Scripture in the round, in the gross, as he puts it, we cannot really depend upon Scripture at all. So in his posthumous works, he moves into this much more skeptical frame of mind. In some places, Chubb seems to anticipate Hume. So here's a quotation from Chubb. Speaking of a miraculous fact, again, the fact may be performed before persons who are well qualified and disposed to examine it strictly, or before weak and ignorant people. Think of Hume's talk about ignorant and barbarous nations. Weak and ignorant people who are more easily misled and imposed upon, or before persons who, from other considerations, are disposed to countenance the report of it. The former of these strengthens, and the latter weakens, the credit of such report. For if a fact be performed before persons who are well qualified and disposed to examine it thoroughly, then there is a probability that a fraud would be detected if there were any. But if it be performed before weak and ignorant people, or before persons who, from other considerations, are disposed to countenance the report, then there is not the same likelihood that a fraud would be detected, and consequently, the credit of the report, under such circumstances, would be so much the weaker. There's much here that's actually quite reasonable. But Chubb, of course, intends to turn it round upon the testimony in the Gospels, and the question of whether he is right to do so will form one part of what Douglas works on in his response to Hume and others called the Criterion. So coming at the end of the course when we consider some of the major responses to Hume's Essay of Miracles, we'll see that Douglas makes use of some of the criteria that Chubb is using here, but that he denies that Chubb has used it properly. So for the qualification part, there's an interesting little twist on this. Hume's use of it, Hume adds something to it. He adds more qualifications. These must be persons of education and learning, credit and reputation in the eyes of mankind. Hume, the learned philosopher, could say this. Chubb, the self-educated candlemaker, would not have added this and probably had better sense than to add these things. Go back and remember what Thomas Sherlock's Mr. B, the Council for the Apostles, says with regard to the question of testimony of the senses. What kind of education is required to tell the difference between a living man and a dead one? Do you need a university degree to do that? Doesn't every man living think he's qualified to make that judgment? That is not something that requires the sort of special training that Hume seems to say it would. The criteria of time and place are particularly things that Douglas picks up on. So this is very interesting. This is a quotation from Chubb, but again, keep in mind where Douglas will go with this later on. The facts, that is, of a reported miracle may be entered upon record at the time of performance, and those records may be made so public at the time and place of the action as may not only dispose but render it very easy for inquisitive persons who live upon the spot to examine the case thoroughly by examining both the record and the evidences of the facts which are to support the credit of that record, or the facts may be entered upon record 10 or 20 or 30 years after the performance, and may be made public in places far distant from the place of action, or be kept as a sacred treasure in the hands of believers. The former of these very much strengthens, and the latter very much weakens, the credit of such records. Again, an interesting methodological comment, and watch the use that Douglas is going to be making of considerations of this kind. Quite an interesting comparison and contrast, since it's Chubb's intention to tear down this sort of evidence, and it's Douglas's intention to show that the miracles of the gospel are well accredited, whereas those of ecclesiastical history are not. As regards even the resurrection, remember Chubb professed himself to be a good Christian, and yet, at the end of his life, in his more skeptical phase, here are some things he has to say. Quote, it may be farther urged that the raising of a dead person to life is a work above the natural ability or inherent power of any created being, and therefore it must be performed by the immediate operation or agency of God. Yes, but, he goes on to say, it may be answered that here is a point presumed without sufficient ground and a consequence drawn from that presumption which in argument is not to be allowed. A skillful surgeon or physician, by a timely interposition, has sometimes prevented death. Yea, sometimes by a timely and proper application from a skillful person, life has been restored after a short cessation. But supposing it may possibly be above the natural ability of man to restore life after 1 or 2 or 3 days cessation, or some other given time, yet it will not follow that it is above the natural ability of every other created being. This quotation from his Discourse on Miracles recalls Tyndall's objection that miracles are pointless because we can't tell whether they're being worked by God or by evil beings. And he, of course, is following, but turning on its head, Falconer's argument. Falconer said a miracle could be worked only by God, because otherwise we couldn't tell whether a miracle was really a certification of something, a sign from God. Tyndall turned that on its head and said a miracle might, for all we can tell, be worked by lesser evil beings, therefore the appeal to miracles is useless. So Falconer's modus ponens was Tyndall's modus tollens. This is something Chubb is picking up on. Some people attract natural adversaries. Chubb attracted a natural adversary in the person of Caleb Fleming. Fleming was an Arian minister, or perhaps even Socinian, certainly not an Orthodox Trinitarian. But he seems to have selected Chubb as his particular target, his white whale, if you will, to use the Herman Melville allusion. And he pursues Chubb mercilessly through book after book after book after book. Remarks on his short dissertation on Providence, remarks on his vindication of his true gospel of Jesus Christ, adamant versions upon Mr. Thomas Chubb's discourse on miracles, truth and modern-day deism at variance, and true deism, the basis of Christianity. So all the way to the end of Chubb's life, Fleming pursued him and answered him at great length. So it makes an interesting study, the pair of these, neither of them orthodox, but Fleming absolutely determined that many things Chubb has to say shall be, must be, shot down. If you're interested at all in following up on Chubb, then Fleming's works would make a good place to start. Chubb also attracted the unfavorable attention of Jonathan Edwards. Edwards was an American philosopher and theologian, and so the fact that by 1754 Edwards was devoting quite a bit of time in his work on the freedom of the will to critiquing Chubb's views is an indication that Chubb's influence had spread across the Atlantic to the United States and was something Edwards considered worth engaging with. I was reading through Edwards' work before class today, and there are roughly 20 places where he names Chubb explicitly and argues against him, engages with his arguments. He clearly just can't stand the guy and thinks that he needs to be refuted. It's a classic contrast. Chubb is an incompatibilist. He thinks that morally significant freedom is not compatible with necessity, or determinism. Edwards is a compatibilist. Morally significant action, freedom is, he thinks, compatible with necessity. And so man doesn't need and doesn't have libertarian free will, whereas Chubb maintains that man does have libertarian free will. So, although the word libertarian isn't used by either of them, there are enough descriptive phrases given that you can trace out this controversy. And it's just an interesting sidelight. That wasn't Chubb's primary target. He wasn't principally arguing against determinism, but what he did attracted considerable attention from one of America's great early theologians. Moving on to Peter Annett, we have another person who simply could not write enough, book after book after book. In fact, almost every year through the mid-1740s, he came out with something new, attacking something that had been written by the Orthodox. He seems to have focused largely on the question of the resurrection. His deism, fairly stated and fully vindicated, is a classic kind of deistical work, neither more nor less interesting than the work of someone like Herbert or Blount, a little more pessimistic in its tone, perhaps. But that was the broad standpoint from which Annett worked. However, he's particularly responding to Sherlock's trial of the Witnesses of the Resurrection. And so in 1744, and in 1745, and in 1749, he vigorously attacks the resurrection. Quite an interesting set of attacks, and since our principal focus in this class is on the appeals to miracles and prophecy, we'll look at those in a little bit more detail. But there's one work on this list that doesn't deal with that, and that's from 1747, The History and Character of St. Paul Examined. That work was provoked by a work written not by a minister, but by a layman. It was written by Lord Lyttelton, who was a well-known poet, and had dabbled in deism in his earlier years, but when he came to a mature age, he reflected on it and became an Orthodox Christian and a good Anglican. He wrote a work entitled Observations on Conversion and Apostleship of St. Paul. And in it, he argued that if you pay attention to the details that we have regarding both Paul's conversion, as we have it recounted or alluded to in Acts 9, Acts 22, Acts 26, and Galatians 1, and then the further life of St. Paul as revealed throughout the second part of the book of Acts and his various epistles, it is not possible to give an account that answers to the facts we have, except the one that Paul himself gives, namely that he was miraculously chosen and converted upon the Damascus Road and set off to be one who was sent, an apostle in the literal sense of the word. So Littleton examines alternative hypotheses. Was he in it for the money? Was he in it for power? Was he in it for some other kind of worldly gain? And in each case, extensively argues no and no and no. That argument circumvents the question of the historical reliability of the Gospels. It's not required to predicate that on the reliability of the Gospels at all. And so Annett, not only wanting to attack the Gospels, but wanting to undermine Christianity altogether, had to frame a response to Littleton's argument. You might find it interesting to compare what Littleton has to say with Annett's criticisms and see how you think the argument should be adjudicated. In 1761, when he was quite an old man, Annett was sentenced to stand in the pillory and to 1 year's hard labor for blasphemy. That was still a punishable crime, and he had certainly gone out of his way, not perhaps quite as far as Wolston, but in his own way gone quite far out of his way to make plain his contempt for Orthodox Christianity. Again, there were many people who were engaged in these controversies who were not happy with the idea of prosecuting such people and condemning them to the jail or the stocks. So this was not a position that was universally accepted, although some of the more respectable Orthodox Anglican bishops did condone it. Annett's book, The History and Character of St. Paul Examined, was freely translated into French by a French critic of Christianity, and so it circulates also under a French title. And then from the French was, and this is curious, translated back into English. Why they would need to translate it when the English was available in the first case, I don't know, but perhaps the book was hard to get hold of. So Paul Thierry, the Baron d'Holbach, was responsible for the French edition of it, and then somebody went to the trouble of translating d'Holbach's rather free rendering of Annett back into English. So there are two versions of this floating around. The one that I've referenced here is the original one. So, what did Annett believe, more precisely? Well, unlike Wolston, he freely discards sections of the Gospel narratives, like the story of the guard set at Jesus' tomb. You'll recall from Wolston's sixth discourse that he makes a big deal out of the setting of the guard at the tomb, and this is something that comes up in Sherlock's trial, examining Wolston's position, right? There's supposed to have been some kind of a compact set up between the apostles and the Jewish rulers, and the fact that there was a seal placed there is a sign of this compact. Sherlock and others dismiss this theory as absurd. Annett doesn't even bother to try to defend it and says quite to the contrary. That's crazy. There wouldn't have been a guard set at the tomb. Why would there have been a guard set? First of all, he argues, Jesus didn't foretell his own death. If he had, it's impossible that his disciples should have been as stupid as they're reported to have been in Mark 9 and Luke 9 after they're coming down from the Transfiguration. So that isn't going to even enter into the data. We're not going to allow that Jesus foretold his own death in any way. The Pharisees, therefore, wouldn't have taken precautions against his body's disappearance. If they thought that he was a deceiver, why would they bother? Leland, I think, gives a good response to this. He says if they thought Jesus was a deceiver, wouldn't they be even more likely to think his disciples were deceivers as well? And in that case, they might actually fear that the disciples would steal the body. That is, after all, what they say according to the narrative of Matthew. So Leland's response here is, I think, a more interesting response and a more defensible response than the one that Sherlock gives in passing in the trial of the witnesses. And it asks, why would the Jews bribe the guards rather than believing their story? After all, if the guards came back and said, an angel came and fell insensate, and, if an angel came, wouldn't that seal it? Leland gives a very interesting response to this. Here's what he says. Whoever considers their determined malice and envy against Jesus, who had unmasked their hypocrisy and opposed their traditions, how deeply their reputation was engaged, and their authority with the people as well as that of the Sanhedrin, who claimed to themselves a power of trying prophets and had condemned him as a false prophet and a blasphemer, must be sensible how unwilling they would be to have it thought that they had wrongfully procured a most excellent person to be crucified, to which may be added the power of their prejudices, which would not suffer them to imagine that a person who had been crucified could possibly be the Messiah, which was absolutely subversive of all their maxims. They who, when they could not deny his miracles, ascribed them to a diabolical power, showed what they were capable of. And indeed the force of obstinate prejudice, hatred, envy, pride, and a desire of maintaining their own authority, all which concurred in this case, is amazing, and hath often caused persons to stand out against the clearest evidence. So there's one example of a dissenting minister. Leland was not a member of the Church of England, but a dissenting minister's rejoinder to the kind of argument that Annett is here making. There's a rather long passage here that I want to quote from his response to some rejoinders by defenders of the resurrection. So this is the second of his books on the resurrection. Regarding reported miracles, here's what Annett says. There is no rule in reason to judge of miraculous power reports but by the ability and honesty of the reporters, nor of their sagacity and fidelity, but by the ability and honesty of all those that transmit their accounts and characters to us, and how certain that this rule is, I leave, sir, to your consideration. And whether the history of uncommon, supernatural, and unaccountable things are as credible as common and natural history. If that of Julius Caesar was mixed with fable and romance, the romantic parts, at least, would not find easy credit with considerate readers. Were men easily to believe such stories, they would be liable to be everlastingly deceived by falsities, frauds, and fictions. 'Tis not reasonable, therefore, to credit unreasonable accounts that are no better attested than holy writings which were sown in weakness but are raised in power. A sarcastic reference to a phrase from the Pauline epistles. This is interesting because we have a bit of correspondence that passed between David Hume and his friend, the minister Hugh Blair. Blair was a friend of Hume on the one hand and George Campbell on the other. And when Campbell wrote his dissertation on miracles as a response to Hume, Blair, at Campbell's urging, passed the manuscript on to Hume so that Hume could say whether he had been misrepresented at any point. Hume does not say that Campbell had misrepresented him, but he says something very reminiscent of what Annett says here. He says to Campbell, "Does a man of sense go running after every tale of hobgoblins and fairies and witches? I never knew a man seriously to enter upon the examination of such a thing, but what he ended up by believing it." In other words, sensible men don't even inquire into these things because they know that they're not credible. People who start inquiring into them are so weak-minded that once they begin inquiring, they're sure to end up believing it. And that's a sure sign that they didn't have good judgment to begin with. So there's quite a similarity between that bit of correspondence, which is quoted in the beginning of several editions of Campbell's dissertation on miracles, and what Annett says here. If someone wants to follow up on that, that might be an interesting place to look for further similarities between Hume's thought and Annett's thought. How does Annett treat contradictions? It's a very interesting point, because to discredit the narratives in the Gospels in particular, and the first chapter of Acts, Annett is very, very free to charge them to be full of contradictions, and he inveighs against them. But the way that he does it is quite interesting. He uses the argument from silence. Anytime that there's a detail or an event that is omitted in one record but present in another, he takes the fact of the omission to be a contradiction of the record that has it in. Now, if we started applying this kind of reasoning to secular history, we could dissolve secular history really, really quickly. But Annett makes this one of his principal weapons, and by the use of the argument from silence, he's able vastly to expand the range of passages that he can call contradictions. So whatever difficulties there might be in direct statements, here, by taking silence as denial, he's able vastly to expand the range of these. And so then he's able to try to make the case that these documents are so full of such errors that there's no possibility that we could take them as being a trustworthy record. Leland gives a list of quite a number of these. So you can find in, I think it's letter 12 of Leland, a listing of some of the places that he does this. I'm going to stop here.